Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Nun Zayin Amud Aleph. The Gemara is discussing what we just saw in the Mishnah, and the Gemara says, "My Dorush." What were they Doresh? The Mishnah is a reference to the practices of the Kutim. It's not clear from the Gemara what the reference is back to the Mishnah. Rashi claims that it's a reference back to the Kutim's practice not to bury Nifelim, not to bury miscarriages. And the Gemara wants to know, my Dorush, what was the source for their practice not to bury the Nifelim? Lo tasig vulreacha asher gavlu rishonim benachalatcha. So this is a halacha that's found in Sefer Devarim, that one should not be moving the borders that were established by the previous generations. Or in essence, you shouldn't steal property by moving where the borderline is between you and your neighbor. But the Gemara here is referencing to a drasha of the Sifrei, which is that lo tasig bulareacha asher gavlu rishonim benachalatecha. Now gavlu rishonim are the demarcations, the areas that were allocated by the earlier generations for burial, and that you are not allowed to abrogate those boundaries that were set by the earlier generations to establish a place as a cemetery or a place as a burial plot. And so then this pasuk, according to the Sifrei, governs that responsibility that a person has, that when he inherits from his forefathers an area which was a burial plot of the family, that he has to keep it as a burial plot of the family. Therefore, the pasuk say reference to burial. And then on that reference of the Sifrei, the Kutim make the following drasha, which is kol sheyesh lo nachala, yesh lo gvul. Anybody who's entitled to a nachala, then they also have a din of gvul. Gvul here is as a reference to burial. Kol sheyein lo nachala, if you're not subject to nachala, ain lo gvul, then you don't have the right to a burial. This is interesting from a number of levels. The first of which, to me, which is very bothersome, is the fact that the Kutim over here are using a drasha of Chazal. It's Torah Shebaal Peh, it's a Misora, as to what the meaning of the pasuk is. And they're leaning on that drasha of Chazal, and then on top of that, building an additional drasha of Nachala versus Gibul, that the pasuk ends with Benachalatcha, and therefore they say that qualifies the previous part of the pasuk to tell you that only someone subject to Nachala has a din of burial. But the Kutim in general did not subscribe to Drashot Chazal, as we're going to see in one second in the next piece of the Gemara. And even if it was interpretive in nature, not a Gzeirat Chachamim, but Torah Shebe'al Peh, they didn't necessarily subscribe to it. That's why it's surprising that they would be subscribing to such a drasha of the Sifrei, of the Midrash Halacha and Sefer Devarim, because that wasn't generally what they did. It does expose a folly or a flaw in most of these traditions that include the Kutim and many others that did not subscribe to Torah Shebaal Peh, which is that it's very hard to read the Torah Shebichtav without the Torah Shebaal Peh. This happens not to be the best example of it, but there are many examples within the Torah Shebichtav that without interpretive explanation, we have no idea what the meaning of the words are inside of the Torah, or the meaning of what the Torah is referencing to. Here there is a Pashtuta Pasuk, but it shows you that even the Kutim, or even the Stukim, the Baitusim, and many others who had practices that were supposedly only rested on Torah Shebichtav, that they still needed a certain amount of interpretation or interpretive law, because otherwise you can't understand Torah Shebichtav. And that again points to the folly or the flaw in these religious sects, because they end up using the Drashot Chazal or explanations of Chazal selectively. And that seems to be what's happening here as well, that they are selectively picking a Drashot Chazal. What's interesting also is the question as to whether their Drasha is a good Drasha. That turns out to be a Machloket Rishonim, and then into the Achronim and Poskim, as to whether the Drasha is just their own Drasha, and we do not subscribe to it, and therefore we believe that Nifelim do require burial, and there is a demand to bury them properly. Or there are those that believe that the drasha was actually a drashat chazal, and that anybody who has a nachala also has a gvul, has a right to burial. Without nachala, there is no burial. The difference between what we interpreted from that and what they interpreted is that even though you're right that a nafel does not have the right to a burial, nevertheless, for purposes of protecting against random tumah being placed all over the place, or out of just proper kavod for the nefel, or that there may be a right to burial, but not necessarily a right to familial burial. For all of those reasons, we do bury a nefel, whereas they did not bury the nefel, or they buried it in the house. And therefore, the drasha is actually a drasha with basis, but nevertheless, the proper interpretation or understanding of it is slightly different. But despite whether you think it is or don't think it is a proper drasha, our practice is to bury it in the nefelim and to give them a proper burial, not necessarily a burial that would be on level with a fully viable entity, but nevertheless, we do bury them in order to protect against tumah and to give acknowledgement that this was the start of the creation of a life. That's with regards to the first drasha. Then the Gemara says, Ne'emanim lomar karvarnu. We said in the Mishnah that the Kutim are believed to say that we buried something here, whether it was a regular burial or a burial in Nefelim, they are believed that they buried over here. And now the Gemara says, V'ha'leitlu lifne'iver lo titem mikshol. This is what I referenced to before, that they did not accept all interpretations of Chazal, and therefore they read lifne'iver lo titem mikshol in its literal form, which means do not put a stumbling block before a blind individual, as opposed to Chazal's interpretation of that, which is that you should not cause others to sin, that you are enjoined to ensure that no one from Klal Yisrael does something wrong, and therefore if you are the facilitating factor for someone doing something wrong, you're in violation of Lifnei Iver Lo Titen Mikshol. They did not subscribe to that interpretation. It is actually a machloket in the Rishonim as to whether we, who follow the interpretation of Chazal, believe that the simple meaning of the pasuk also has application, meaning that if you put a stumbling block before a blind person, would you be chayav malkot for that? So that's a question within the Mefarshei HaMikra, but nevertheless, they do not accept Chazal's interpretation, which is only interesting in the face of what we just read in the previous part of the Gemara, that they did accept the Sifrei's interpretation of Lo Tasik Bol Re'acha Asher Gavlu Rishonim and Achlatukha. But given that, how can you believe what they're telling you? They worry about their own practice of mitzvot. They don't worry about anybody else's practice of mitzvot, so they would not be want to lie about whether there's tumah there or not tumah over there, because they don't feel that they're enjoined from protecting you against doing the aveira of becoming tamei, especially if you were a kohen. I'm ever Rabbi Avoh, but kohen omeid sham. So the kohen kuti is standing there. Vidoma kohen tamei who? Maybe it is a kohen who's already tamei. Now, the truth is that we have, from the Gemarot in Nazir, Chazal established that a kohen who's already tamei may not continue to become tamei. So even today, where most kohenim are already tamei'im, meitim, we do not allow them to become more tamei, the tumata meitim. We don't allow them to go into Beit HaKvarot. We don't allow them to come to tamei, tumata meit, in addition to already being tamei, tumata meit. So it's clear, as the Balei Tosafot point out, that they did not subscribe to that. But the fact that Chazal say over here that maybe he's a kohen tamei, and therefore he doesn't worry about that there is tumah over there, then it wouldn't help you in determining whether there really is tumah or not. Where it says, nakat truma biyodei. He's holding truma in his hand. So he's a kohen kuti who would not make himself tamei. Gemara says maybe if he's already tamei, he would make himself tamei. So the Gemara adds that he's eating truma. They're makbid on the mitzvot of Yoraita, and the Torah says, you may not eat truma, you are tamei. Or it says, tilma, truma, tmeiya. Maybe it's truma that is already tmeiya. The same way that they don't think there's any problem with making the kohen tamei, they also think that if you have truma tmeiya, that it also would not be problematic to bring it into a place that is tamei. Where it says, the ka'achil mina, that he's eating the truma. So, as Rashi says over here, that there is a restriction against someone who is tahor from eating trumat me'ah, then kol shekein, someone that is a kohen that is me'ah, should be enjoined from eating trumat me'ah. The kol shekein is interesting because the logical inference is not necessarily true, which is that you could think that a kohen tahor may not eat trumat me'ah, but a kohen tamei could eat trumat me'ah, because of the fact that he's tamei, that's what entitles him to truma tmeya. Happens to be that that's not the way that we think, but it's not as obvious as Rashi says that it's a kosher gain here. Rashi also says that it's an isur, lav, or nazara, Whereas as the Rabbi Eger points out, that with regards to eating of Trumat Me'ah, it's an Iser Aseh and not an Iser Lav. Therefore, the Kosher Kain also, if you say that a Tahor is not allowed to eat Trumat Me'ah because it's an Iser Aseh, then the same would be true with a Kohen Tameh if he is also restricted. It's only restricted in an Iser Aseh. But nevertheless, because they keep or they are Shomrei Mitzvot when it comes to things that are Doraita, and when it comes to practices that they accepted, they were as makpid as a regular Israel. So here he would have been makpid on the Tumah. Where it says, Yochi Ma'ana Memra. Once you have all this evidence that he's not lying because he's a Kohen who's standing there eating Tumah, so it's obvious that the place where he's standing in is not Tameh Tumah Ta'ohel, then what are you adding for me, the fact that we believe him in that situation? Ma'udutayma, I would have thought Lo Bikiye B'Yitzirah, that they're not so careful or they don't have precision with regards to the development of a fetus, and therefore they will determine that a fetus is not considered to be Tumat Ohel, or is not a entity that would convey Tumah, because they think it was too early in the gestation, and they'd make that mistake. So maybe you would think that they don't have the skills or the discerning power to deal with that issue. Kamash Malan, that we believe them, that in that area of Halacha, they were well-versed or they understood the developmental stages, and therefore if a Kohen is willing to stand there, and obviously they believe in Tumat Ameth and Tumat Ohel, and therefore if he's standing there eating Tumah, that's good evidence of the fact that that area is not Tameh, or what he's telling you is actually true. The other thing which is very interesting about this piece in the Gemara is that the Gemara mentions that there was a Kohen Kuti. And the truth is, how do you have a Kohen Kuti? The Kutim are a peoples that move to the Shomron, and they're Gerim, they're converts, irrespective of whether they wholeheartedly converted. Nevertheless, there's no way that there can be a Kohen from the Kutim. So how do they have a Kohen Kuti? And obviously, if a Kohen from Israel marries a Kuti woman, the children are Israelim, because the Yichus goes after the father, not the mother. And therefore, it shouldn't be that you have a Kohen Kuti. So either you have to say that the Kohanim that they're referencing to are their own Kohanim, that they had a priestly class within the Kutiim, not that they were real Kohanim, but they treated them like Kohanim, and those Kohanim acted with the lochot of Kohanim, and so they kept the mitzvot of Tumah for a Kohen. Or it's possible that in the Psukim, in Melachim Bet, when it speaks about the Melech of Ashur, that when they did population exchanges, and they brought the Kutiim to the Shomron, it says over there that they also brought them a Kohen from amongst the Jews to help them to understand what the practices were of that area, to protect them from the dangers of that area. And so there was a Kohen that was brought, or Kohanim that were brought to teach them. And maybe it's a reference to those Kohanim who assimilated, intermarried within the Kutim. And so there was a priestly class of Kohanim, descendants of that Kohen or those Kohanim that were brought to teach them the laws of the area. Ne'emanim ala beima. Mishnah also says that they are believed with regards to kedushat bechor for an animal that is birthing. You have the same problem again, which is they don't worry about causing other people to sin, and therefore how can you believe them to tell you that this animal already had a baby beforehand, or this animal did not have a baby beforehand? It's where this particular individual is also shearing and working with the animal, which is restricted with regards to a bechor. So that's a clear indication that they don't believe that this animal is a bechor. Once again, if you have that much evidence, which isn't just coming from their testimony or from their statement, but it's coming from their actions, and they're acting according to what they're saying, then of course we should believe them. Where it says, Ma'adutema lo bikiye bitinuf. We would have thought that they're not so well-versed in the discharge that comes from a behemah daka, and that tinuf, or that discharge of dam and mucus that comes out of the animal, to determine whether that is a miscarriage that makes the next baby that's born not be a bechor, or whether this is simply a discharge and not evidence of a birth. We would think they didn't have, again, either that discerning power or that expertise to deal with it. Kamash Malan, that we trust them with regards to those matters, and once we have evidence of the fact that they can be believed because they're acting upon whatever statement they're making, then we will believe them and we will assume that they had the knowledge or ability to be discerning with regards to whether there was a birth beforehand or not. Even though a birth doesn't necessarily mean a full-fledged birth of a fetus, even if it means a discharge or a miscarriage, they have that information and understanding and can be discerning with that manner. They're believed with regards to demarcating kvarim, burial plots or cemeteries. Even though this is a rabbinic injunction that is just in place in order to help the Kohanim and those that were Shomer Tahara, so these demarcations or indications of cemetery or Tumah help those individuals to avoid becoming Tameh. But it's a rabbinic institution that you should paint or put lime, plaster on those areas to indicate that there is Tumah there. Nevertheless, they subscribe to it. Kevan Dechtiva, since it's written in the Pasuk, Mizar Zihirebe, they are careful about it. So even though it's not in the Torah, it is in Tanakh. And so even though this is a Din Derabbanan, it's a Din Derabbanan that's Nismach ala Pasuk that's found in the Navi. Dechtiv, it says in Yechezkel with regards to the Gog and the burial of the troops, the armies of Gog, Vira'a etzem adam uvana etzlotzion, so that they will find the bones of an individual, and they will put up a demarcation or a marking next to those bones or around those bones after they bury them to indicate Tumah. So since it's found in the Psukim, they don't see this simply as a rabbinic institution. They see this as already something that came through the Mesorah, and it's already written in the Torah Shebichtav, not Torah itself, but in Tanakh Shebichtav, and therefore they do subscribe to it. Avel Eina Emanim, Lo Askachot, Lo Aperot, Lo Beit HaPras. They're not believed with regards to all these tumot dirabanan. Sichachot, what is the sichachot that we're describing over here? It's none. That we have a Mishnah in Oalot, Elu ein sichachot. This is the definition of sichachot, Ilan, Amesech al-Aretz. It's a tree that casts shade or shadow over the ground or the area there. With regards to perot, we also have, it's none, Mishnah, Tosefta in Oalot. The Gros says that the word avanim should be taken out. To read Perot Yotzot Min HaGader, these are stones or projections that protrude out of the wall. And so, as Rashi notes over here, is something that is samuch to the entranceway to the cemetery, and they were under pressure sometimes to bury, which is that if it came late on a Friday when they were going to bury, or even if it was late in the day, and they were carrying the mate to the Beit HaKvarot, to the cemetery, but it got so late that if it started to become dark, they would stop before they got to the cemetery and bury the individual on the way to the cemetery. In that they weren't necessarily always getting to the cemetery, and therefore we worry about the fact that they buried in these areas. So now you have what's called the Safek Tumah, because if they buried anywhere in these areas, the tree creates an ohel, and that ohel would then spread the Tumah around this area. So the Chachamim were takein that in those areas where there was Eilan Mesach, or these praot, these stones that protruded from the walls, places where there is suspicion or possibility that someone buried there because they're on the way or close enough to the cemetery that someone under duress might bury in those areas, then we don't allow Kohanim, or people don't want him to come to me, to go under these trees, under these protruding rocks, because it may be mahil on them and whatever Tumah is there. And because of that, they instituted Tumah Midrabanan, so that if you did go under those areas, you would be Tumah Midrabanan. It's obviously the Kutim do not subscribe to this, because it's all a rabbinic institution. It has no smach minakra. It's not from the Torah, and doesn't even have a pasuk that backs up the institution of this Takana Midrabanan. Tosfot says that the Ilan HaMesach is not exactly how Rashi described it, but rather, he says it's a case where we know for certain that there's a mate buried there. We just don't know which branch the mate is buried. And therefore, if you walk under the tree and you don't know if it was the branch under which the mate is buried, so that would have been a Safek Tumah. And Safek Tumah Bishutei Yachid is Tameh, Bishutei Rabim is Tahor. And so over here, you might have thought that it's a Safek Bishutei Rabim should be Tahor. Nevertheless, the Chachamim were gozer, made a takana here that you'd be tameh anyway, because we want you avoiding this area, not going anywhere near the tree, given that one of the branches of the tree is mahil al tumah tameh. That's how the Balei Tosfot explain it. Tosfot does not believe that this was done in a haphazard manner. He says rather it was a situation in which it was intentionally buried there. And they know that there's a plot there, but they have no idea or they don't remember where that burial was done underneath the tree. And so that's what the problem is. You have a kever that's basically lost under the tree, and therefore we restrict you from going anywhere under the tree, even though technically it's a safek, tuma b'shut harabim, which should have been tohor. And then the pra'ot would be the same thing according to the Balei Tosafot, which is that you have a fence that has stones that are protruding from it, and they did bury someone along this fence under one of those protrusions. We're just not sure which of those protrusions the burial took place under. And therefore, you restricted me, the Rabbanan, from going under any of these protrusions, even though it might be a safek tuma that might have been okay to enter into. Nevertheless, the Chachamim goes there that you shouldn't enter into those areas, or you shouldn't put yourself into such a safek. Then the last of the items that was mentioned in the Mishnah, which was a tuma midrabanan, where the Kutim did not subscribe to it, was Beit HaPras. As we're going to see in a second, the problem of Beit HaPras is that you had a burial in that area, and then someone plowed the field. And after plowing the field, what we're worried about is that whatever was remaining of that individual that was in this burial plot is now distributed throughout the field. As Rashi notes over here, pras is from Lashon, davar shabur uparus. Something that is broken or subdivided. We use it, kedei achilat pras. Pras means a piece of the bread, broken piece of the bread, or to break bread from the broken piece of the bread. And similarly over here, the situation is that the atzamot, or the skeletal remains, shenifreshu atzamot, were broken up, subdivided or distributed amongst the area of the field. That's why it's called a Beit HaPras. So Tosafot notes over here, and I mentioned this when we did it in the Mishnah, that the word Beit HaPras actually establishes, or it's related to a certain term, like Rashi says over here, where you have a burial plot in a field, and that gets distributed or broken up by a plow. That's your classic Beit HaPras. The problem is that the Gemara in other places in Shas uses Beit HaPras not in that context. For instance, we're going to see in a second in a Braita that's brought, and Tosafot also quotes it from Moed Katan, that a Sadeh, Shenevad Bo, a field in which there was lost a kever, there was a burial plot that was lost, meaning that they know somebody was buried somewhere in this area, but they have no idea where it is. They call that a Beit HaPras. And that is evidenced by the Braita that we bring in Moed Katan, that Rashi quotes as well, which is that there are Gimel Beit HaPras saying. There are three types of Beit HaPras. Sadeh Shavad Bakever, a field in which a burial plot was lost. Sadeh Shanechash Bakever, a place where a burial plot was plowed over. And then the Ste Abochim. And the Balei Tosfot over here discuss what exactly they think maybe Ste Abochim. Ste Abochim is a field, the meeting point between the people of the city who were taking the mate out and the people from the burial society. It was the area where they used to cry and they used to do the eulogies. Question is, why would there be a chashash tuma? Number two is the Gemara there mentions that the person is mityayesh, that they have given up hope. One possibility is that a field that will have private ownership, but the person gave up hope of ever taking the field back because of its public usage or the easement that's been created, that they do this all the time. So maybe that's what the yeush is. The question as regards to tuma, the Balei Tosafot say either it's a possibility that when they stop there in order to cry and exchange or pass on the mate to the people who are going to do the burial, then something fell out of the mitah, or some piece of the mate fell out, so maybe that's the fear of tuma there. Or the other possibility is that maybe the people of the city came out and dropped off the mate there, assuming that the people from the burial society are going to come and pick him up, and they never do come and pick him up. Or the other way around, the people of the burial society thought the people were going to bring it all the way to the kever, and they didn't, and therefore they didn't go out to greet it, and it got left there, the mate. Or it's a case where they temporarily leave the mate in those areas before they put them into the kuchim, before they put them into the catacombs. So any one of those reasons, the Balei Tosafot said that that Ste Abochim, which is the third Beit HaPras that's mentioned in Moed Katan, has a din of tuma midrabanan for the fear of any one of these different possibilities of taking place. And so that's why Chazal were gozer in those cases. But again, that gives Beit HaPras a much broader meaning in these contexts. Now, the Gemara explains that Beit HaPras, Amar Rabbi Yehuda HaShmuel, Menapeach Adam Beit HaPras, Veolech. A person can go through Beit HaPras by getting down on their hands and knees and blowing the area in front of them, the dirt or the dust that's in front of them, to clear it out, to see what's there, and then he can slowly make his way through the field in such a manner. And Rav Yehuda bar Ami, Mishmei Rav Yehuda Amar, Beit HaPras, Shinidash, Tor. If you have a Beit HaPras that is well-worn, you have that there was a path through there that compacted the earth that was there, and now it's a well-worn and compacted path, then also over there, there's not a problem of Beit HaPras. The reason in both of these instances is because the problem of Beit HaPras is that you had a burial in that area, and then someone plowed the field. And after plowing the field, what we're worried about is that whatever was remaining of that individual that was in this burial plot is now distributed throughout the field. Now, because I'll assume that if that happened, whatever of the mate is distributed is too small to be mitameh tumat ohel. So you could technically walk to this area now and not worry about tumat ohel because there's not sufficient amount of the mate in a singular place to make it that it has tumat ohel. Generally with bones, you need either rov minyan, the majority of the number of bones in the body, or rov binyan, or the majority of the structure of the individual, which isn't so many bones, but the Mishnayot and Aholot describe it as the large bones of the body altogether. So again, that type of skeletal remain to be intact after it was plowed over is very unlikely, and therefore the tumat oil was not an issue. The tumat that we do worry about was tumat maga, that you might come into contact with a bone, because even an etzem kiseura, even a bone the size of a barley seed, has a din of tumat maga and tumat masa. So therefore, we worry about you stepping on, coming into contact with a small fragment of bone. We also worry about the fact that even if you don't come into contact with them, if you walk on that area, there might be tumat masar hesed, which is that you will cause the bone to move, even though you don't touch it directly. Both of those would render you tamei tumat tamei. So even though that is a more far-fetched worry or a suspicion that we have, nevertheless, Chazal were gozer in this instance to say that there is still tumah. So then, they also said that you can overcome that tumah by doing certain things that prevent you from having problems of tumat magan masa. So one of those is if you walk, go through the field on your hands and knees, blowing in front of you, clear the area to make sure that there is no bone fragment that's there. So if you're ready, clear away the area in front of you by blowing on it, you'll know if there's a bone fragment or not. Then we don't have to worry about tumat magar, tumat tesei. The other possibility is where the path has been well worn and the earth has been compacted. In that situation, any fragment of a bone either was now pulverized and does not exist, or it has been depressed into the ground to the point where it's not visible, and if you couldn't touch it anymore because it was depressed or pushed in, and you can't do hesate anymore because the earth is so compacted that when you step on it, it doesn't move anymore, and therefore there's no tumat hesate. So those are two dispensations for crossing through a Beit HaPras, and that is only subject to tumat midrabanan. Because midoraita, we assume that everything was distributed in a way that will not make you tamei anymore. Rabbanan instituted that we should worry about it in this situation, and therefore they also gave dispensations to get around the problem. Tanya, that a choresh beit hakvarot, someone who plows an area that had a cemetery or had somebody that was buried there, harizeh oseh beit hapras. That person creates a beit hapras. Vad kama hu oseh. When you plow the field, how far from the area of where the buried individual was do we say that it's considered to be a Beit HaPras? The answer is Melo Ma'ana. It is the length of a furrow, Mea Ama, which is 100 Amot, Beit Arbaat Sa'in, an area that would either produce 4 Sa'a or an area that would be seeded by 4 Sa'a. That is a Machlok and Mishonim. So when you say Beit Sa'ayim, Beit Sa'a, or here, Arbat Sa'in, but that's a description of the productivity of the field, how much this field would produce. So you need an area that would produce 4 Sa'a, or does it mean that you have an area that you would seed with 4 Sa'a? That is a machloket in the Rishonim. But over here, the area is Beit Arbat Sa'im, as Rashi notes that the Mishkan was 100 Amot by 50 Amot, and that's called a Beit Sa'atayim. So if you're talking about 100 by 100, that's double the size of the Mishkan, or basically Beit Arbat Sa'im, an area that is 4 Sa'a, and that is an area that's 100 Amot by 100 Amot, a square area like that, based on the length of a furrow. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Chamesh, It's not four sa'ah, but rather five sa'ah. And as Tosfot points out, that the 100 amot, based on the Tosefta, is in all directions. So meaning wherever the burial plot was, and then you plowed, the plow carries in every direction 100 amot. So it actually then would be much bigger than a Beit Arba Tzayim, because it'd be Beit Arba Tzayim in every direction. It would be a center point with 100 amot spoke going out in every direction, because that's the length of which the plow would carry such a skeletal remain when it plows over a grave. So Gemara says, "Below Mehemne, are they not believed these kutim with regards to Tumat Beit Apras? Ve'atanyo, don't we have a braita Sadesh Avad Bakever? A field in which a kever was lost." Again, we discussed this in the Baal Tosafot, that this might be considered a Beit HaPras. The problem is that if the word pras means broken fragments or distributed fragments, then in this case, that's not what happened. In this case, they know about a burial plot. The problem is we have no idea where it is, not the fact that the area was plowed over. And the Baal Tosafot say again here, maybe it's a borrowed term. Since the terminology that's used when you plow over the field is for a safek, tumat hamet, that is found from a burial plot. So they take that terminology and apply it, even though it's not the same scenario or the same case over here. They'll say that when you have a burial plot that's lost in a field or an area of fields, that also is considered to be a beit hapras, not literally a beit hapras, but a borrowed term, which means I have a safek, tumat hamet in this area, and that's why they call it a beit hapras. Or, Tosafot then gives a different interpretation of the word paras, not like Rashi, which means to be broken up or distributed or subdivided. Rather, prasot means base of people's feet don't go in that area because of the tuma. So that's also a terminology, which is the word prasot is a reference to the base of your foot, and the people's feet do not go to that area because of the tuma. And so he says, maybe if that's the understanding of Beit HaPrasot, then it could have wider meaning, and it could have the meaning, like we say, Moed Katan, as well as the meaning that we spoke about here as well. And the Baal Tosafot say that, obviously, in this scenario or situation, the kulot that we mentioned before would not be applicable, because the kulot before applicable, because we believe that the skeletal remains were distributed all over the field, and there's no longer an area where there is enough of the mate aggregated to create Tumat Oel, that would not be true in this scenario, because here the mate is whole, we just don't know where he is in the field. And therefore, these dispensations may not apply. Although, if you believe that it's an area where the kever was lost, and then the fields were also plowed over, then you would be faced with the same situation, the same etherim would apply. But then we say about that, Neman kuti lomar ein sham kever. Kuti is believed to say that there is no burial plot there, or to say it's not in this field. The fish ain't me'id el gufo shel kever, because he's not testifying about the nature of the tuma. He's testifying to the fact that there is no burial over there, as Rashi says over there, the gufo shel kever do uraito, and the fact that there is a requirement for burial, and that the burial plot or area where it is creates tumata oel is a din do uraito. And with regards to dine do uraito, we do believe them because they are makpid on Dine Doraita. Ilan Shumesach al Aretz, and you have a tree that casts a shadow or its branches expand over. Neman Lomar Ein Tachtav Kever. He's believed to say that under this branch, under this area, there is no kever, there is no burial plot. V'sheinu Me'id Ela Gufo Shel Kever. Because once again, his testimony is not about the institution Midr Rabbanan as to whether this person who goes under there is Tameh or not Tameh. Rather, he's testifying about the burial plot itself, which is, again, a din d'oraita or tuma d'oraita, and there he's believed. So why is he believed? And even if you say it's a din d'oraita, we said before that they're not makpid only tnei iver lo titen mikshol. They don't worry about causing other people to sin. So why should they be believed in this instance? So Amar Rabbi Yochanan b'me'aleich u'ba'al pnei kula. It's an instance where the individual, we have to assume it's a kohen over here, where he walks over that whole area, and therefore it's clear that he believes it's not Tameh, because otherwise he wouldn't walk over that whole area. Where it says, Ihochi Maida Memra, if that's the case that he walks the entire area, and therefore defines for us by action that it's not Tameh, because it's the Dindo Raita that he himself would have violated had he walked over that area, then what do you need me to tell you that he's believed? Of course he's believed. So Madhutema Rutsua Nafka, what do you think? That there was a small path. He could tiptoe through the tulips. He knew exactly where the tumata mate was. And there was a path that weaved its way through to make sure that it didn't touch any of the tumata mate. And he knows that path. And therefore, when he walked around, he followed that path. You would think maybe that is a chashash here, and therefore he shouldn't be believed. The mashmalan, that we don't worry about that unusual scenario or a far-fetched case where he has a way through that would not make him tamei, and therefore he deceptively walks through there trying to show that there is no kever there. We don't worry about that, and we believe him in this instance. Tosafot says at the end here that the test that Rabbi Yochanan says works by the case of whether there's a grave under a tree or a grave that's lost in the field. Over there, we allow him to walk the entire area, and if he does that, then we believe him. That's because he's testifying about the kever. On the other hand, if it was a field in which the plow distributed the skeletal remains all over because it was a kever there and they got plowed over, in that case, even if he walks the entire field, we do not believe him. And that's because of a principle that Rashi lays out here. Tosafot seconds, that is, Eineman, the finish Einu Chash ala Safek. They don't worry about Safek Tuma. We have a position that Safek Tuma Bishut Rabim is Tahor. Safek Tuma Bishut Yachid is Tameh. The Kutim believe that all Safek Tuma is not an issue, and they do not worry about Safek Tuma whatsoever. So the Kohen would feel free to walk through the entire field if he believed it was only a Safek Tuma, not a real Tuma. Therefore, just because he walks through the field doesn't give us evidence of the fact that there wasn't a mate that was here that got plowed over in this field, forgetting about the fact that's an institution, either Rabbanan. Even without that, they don't worry about, even on a Doraita level, Safek Tuma. Therefore, their walking through the field will not be evidence of the fact that there is no Tuma there. And so Rashi and the Tosafot over and over again over here mention the fact that anytime there is a Safek Tuma, then the Kutim will not worry about it. Or they don't believe that that Tuma is problematic. And therefore, even if they were to personally engage with that area, that would not be evidence of the fact that there is no Tuma there. Other than when we're talking about the Kever, as it says in the Braita, but it's an absolute Kever in a single location, there they believe that it's a din of Tuma Doraita, not a Safek. And therefore, if they walk through that entire area, you can be certain that there is no Kever there, and you can believe them in that instance. At the end of the Mishnah says, Zaklau, this is the principle that's established by the Mishnah. Anything that they subscribe to or they believe in, they are as careful as any Israeli, and therefore they can be trusted. In areas that they do not keep the halacha, then they are chashudim. Gemara says about that, Zaklau letuye mai. What does that come to include? Areas that we don't believe them in. Latuye tchumin v'yayin nesech. Comes to include tchumim of Shabbat, and Yayin Nesech, Yayin that was touched by a Nachri. Both of those are institutions, Midrabanan, assuming that we don't hold like Rabbi Akiva and the Gemara and Shabbat, that's Chumim Ardoraita. Or even if you think we do hold like Rabbi Akiva, maybe that's for a much larger area, Midoraita, Midrabanan, it's only 2,000 Amot, even according to Rabbi Akiva. And so these are institutions, Midrabanan, and they're not believed. Seems obvious, because again, they don't subscribe to Dinei Derabanan. The point here might be that both of these have a hint in the psukim. And since they're hinted to in the psukim, maybe that's enough of a reason to believe that they would have subscribed to these mitzvot. Like by Tchumim, it says, Ayetze Ishmim Komo B'Yom HaShabbat. So again, we interpret that differently, but they might see that as referencing to Tchumim. If that's the case, maybe they would subscribe to the din of Tchumim Midrabanan, even though it's only rabbinic in nature. And similar with the Yayin Nesech, as we say, Yayin Nisicham. The Yayin of the non-Jews was called Yayin Nisicham. It's called the Yayin Nesech. Again, that's found in Sefer Dvarim, a pasuk that seems to indicate such. And even though, again, these are asmachtot midrabanan that the takanot are based on, nevertheless, because maybe there's a pasuk backing up, we would have thought that they subscribe to these mitzvot, kamash malan, that they're not believed in these areas of halacha because they're only derabanan. Okay, with that, we end the seventh parak, Hadron Alach, Damanida. And now we move on to the eighth parak, which is an area of halacha that we began to discuss in the previous parak, but has major implications, especially today in halacha lemaisa with regards to nida, and that is because the majority of nidot today are determined by this factor, which is the discovery of the dam after it's already been discharged from the body. That's either through a stain on the clothing of the woman, or a discharge of dam from her body, or dam that's found on her body. All of those are tamim, as they're called. Those are evidence of a menstrual discharge. But the Torah, as we're going to see in a second, requirement for a menstrual discharge to be considered a nidah, it requires a hargasha, a sensation of the discharge itself happening in order to be tamei tumah d'oraita. And given that, it's unlikely or unusual for a woman to discover her being a nidah in that way, whether it is because the natures of individuals have changed, or more likely the focus on this matter has changed. In the time of the Gemara, where the world itself or the environment, the ambiance was much quieter and quiescent, so then women were much more aware of what was going on in their bodies. In addition to the fact that it had such major implications in terms of Tuman Tahara, so they were much more makbid on these things, and maybe therefore they had the sensations or were aware of the sensations, whereas today we don't really have that. And so therefore the majority of nidot are determined by exactly this method, which is Haruah Ketem al Bisara, person who sees a stain on her body, Keneged Beit HaTofra, if it's opposite the area where she would have discharged the blood from, then Tmeyah, because we can assume that the dam came from her and then landed on her body wherever it is. Shalom Keneged Beit HaTofra, on the other hand, if it's found somewhere on her body that does not face the area where it would have been discharged from, then she is Tohra. Ala Keva, if it's on her heel, Varosh Kulda, or on her toe, Tmeyah. In both of those instances, she is Tmeyah. The heel, because when she sits, and she could be sitting on her heels could be near the area where the discharge happened. On her toes, because of either that, or when she's standing, it could have fallen from her and landed on her foot. Al Shoka, Val Parsotea, Mibifnim. If it is on her thigh, or her feet, on the inside, meaning the area of the thighs that face each other, or the areas of the feet where they face each other, then Tmeyah. That's an area, again, which could face the Beit HaTorfa, could be from when she sat, could be from when she stood up. That's areas where dam can reach. On the other hand, Mibachutz, she finds dam on the outer side of her thighs, or on the outer side of her feet, Tehora. We assume that she is Tehora because the dam from her would not have reached those areas naturally. It seems unusual, and it must have come from the outside, not from her internally. Valat stadim mikan umikan, or on the front of the thigh, or the back of the thigh, again, that don't face the Beit HaTorfa, Teora, they are Teorim, because we wouldn't expect the dam, Nida, to reach those areas. Rata al chaluka, if she sees on her clothing, minachagur lamato, if it is below the waistline, Tmeyah, then we assume that it came from that area, and she is Tmeyah. Minachagur lamala, from the waistline and up, Tehora, we assume she is Tehora, because we assume that if she was Tmeyah and it had come from her, we would see under the lower part of the chaluk. The upper part of the chaluk doesn't make sense to see dam there. Elim Cain, the woman, went into a physical position that turned her body upside down, which the Gemara will discuss. Then you would have to be suspicious of the fact that maybe the dam did come from that area. Ratal Beit HaYad Shel HaChaluk, if she sees it on the sleeve of the tunic, Imagia Keneged Beit HaTofa, if it's an area of the sleeve that can reach to the area in front of where she discharges the dam from, Tmeyah. Vimlav, if not, Tehora, then she is Tehora, because it's on an area of her arm which wouldn't be exposed to that area, and therefore it wouldn't be expected to see dam there. Hayta Poshatato Umitkase Bo Balayla, if she takes it off and puts it on in the middle of the night, Kol Makom Shenimtza Bo Ketem Tmeyah, then any place you find a stain, she is Tmeyah, Beneshu Chuzer, because the chaluk, the tunic in this case, both from the perspective of being turned inside out and right side in, happens because it's in the middle of the night and you're taking it off and you're putting it on, as well as the fact that sometimes you get it on from the bottom, from the top, it gets turned over, it gets moved around, because there's so much movement and so much interaction between the tunic and the individual, then there's a possibility of dam landing on all places on the tunic and not limited to those areas that would come towards the area where the dam is being discharged. And the same is true with apolios, which is obviously a Greek word. Rashi describes it over here as a maforet, which is a cape of sorts that the person covers themselves with. There are others that speak about it being a head covering of sorts, but the general description the Gemara uses in other places to describe a barber that puts a maperet on, which seems to be like a cape or something to protect the individual from the hair that's being taken off when they are cutting their hair. And so it's over there by a polios. And since it moves around or swings around, it doesn't have a defined position. Then no matter where you find the dam, it's problematic because it could have been the front last time, the back this time, could have been up here, down there, because it's a much more undefined type of beged, then anywhere on the beged would be problematic.
In terms of tamim in general,
the reason that the woman is not tmeya midoraita is because you really have what's called sveika here. You have a double level of sveik. The first level of sveik that you have here is whether the dam that we're finding on this beged came from the woman internally, or it came from an external dam. Well, that means she went through the butcher shop, she was working with an animal that was shechted, and she was cleaning it out. And that there are all sorts of reasons, especially in their day, where there could be a stain found on the beged, stain of blood also, but that came from an external exogenous variable, not from her internally. So that's the first level of safek. The second level of safek is, even if it comes from her internally, it has to come from dam ha-mekor. It has to be dam that was discharged from the uterus in order for it to be classified as dam nida. So you have a second safek, which is even if there is a discharge, how do you know the dam is coming from the uterus? Given that it's a sveik sveika, midoraita, we would have said this woman is tohora, and we wouldn't have worried about it. The Chachamim instituted that despite the sveik sveika, we worry about it, or we assume that the woman is a nida. That might be for a number of different reasons. One of which is the sveik sveika such a good sveik sveika? Is it really a double sveik? Or in the end, is it really one single sveik, which is this dam of the uterus, or is this not dam of the uterus? And that would be the really only question that matters. Whether that dam came from outside or internally, it doesn't really matter. The only question is it the dam of the uterus or not? Therefore, maybe it's only a single sveik, not a sveik sveika because of that. Or we could limit the probabilities from the sveik sveika and raise the possibilities that there is something suspicious here. That's one. Second of all is that since the woman has a tendency to see dam and she has a cycle, then the sighting of dam or a stain is not something that is extraordinary. It's something that you could have expected or something that would be plausible to explain as being a menstrual discharge. And so because of that, Chazal leaned towards saying that the tamim are tmeim and make her into a nida because there's circumstantial evidence that maybe this came from her dam nida. And so that's why, despite the fact that maybe in these instances lacking the hargasha and being a sveik sveika, we should have been lenient in these situations, we weren't lenient because Chazal felt that there was either circumstantial evidence or the probabilities in the sveik sveika were not as small as it sveik sveika makes it seem like. And therefore, they were instituted that a ketem, or the sighting of a ketem, would be evidence of the woman becoming a nida. So Amar Shmuel, batka karka olam, if she checked the area where she wants to sit down on the ground, and it was clean, v'yashvala, and then she sits down there, umetzah damala, and then after that she finds dam, a stain of dam, in the area that she checked, and then she sat on, tehora. We say that she is tehora, shenemar bibsara. The pasuk says that mishaki tei zava dam yezova bib sara shivat yamim tei benidata v'chonogea bayit madarev. So bib sara means that the discovery of the dam needs to be bib sara ad shetargish bib sara. So she, it's the sensation of the flow leaving the uterus. That's when you have a din of tumat nida, not when you find dam on the ground. Now Shmuel's statement, at least at this point, seems to be indicating that midoraita, this is a requirement, and maybe even derabonan, you would be Torah in this case, until we get to the end of the Gemara today, that will not seem to be the assumption. Later on, when the Gemara backs away a little bit from the statement of Shmuel, it seems to be that it is Torah midoraita, but there are instances where midorabanan, we would say you are tmeya, even though technically she should have been Torah, because this doesn't qualify as nida midoraita. The Gemara asks about this, hi bibsara. That term bibsara, mi boile, you need it for something else. Shitmeya bin bifni mi bechutz. We learned bibsara to teach us that unlike by shichmat zera and zav, where the emission must leave the body in order for the person to be tamei, we learned from the bibsara that even the discovery of the dam internal to the woman makes her tmeya. As soon as it discharges from the uterus, she is tmeya, even though it has not yet left her body yet. And we learned that from the word bibsara. So we already have a limud from the word bibsara. How can you learn something else? Where it says, im gain le makra, bibsar, or bibasar. You should have used the shorter terminology that could have explained it that way. My bibsara. So then what's bibsara, which now is extraneous wordiness here, that leads us to learn, shmamina, two things. Ashitargish bibsara, that we need it for both things. To teach us that she's tmeya, as soon as it discharges from the uterus, and that she is tmeya only when she has her hargasha, she has a sensation of the discharge. Don't we need bibsara to teach you that the discharge has to come through her body, meaning that it has to touch the beit arechem in order for it to be classified as dam nida? And therefore, if you put in a piping, a catheter, that allows the blood to flow out without touching the woman, it would not make her tmeya. Or if it is discharged inside of a chunk of something solid, then also it does not make the woman tmeya because the dam didn't touch the walls of the beit arechem. And that we learn from bibsara. It has to be discharged from her internally in her basar. It has to be touching her when it's discharged. If not, then it's not dam nida, or she's not classified as a nida. So we need it for that limud as well. Mar says, tarte shmamina. We learn two things. Bibsara has that meaning. It has multiple meanings to it. Bibsara teaches you that it has to be touching the basar. And bibsara also teaches you that it is something that she has to have a sensation for, something that she has to feel. And bibsara also teaches you the third item, which is that even when it's internal to her, the discharge makes her tmeya. So two of those items we can learn from the extraneous wordiness of the pasuk of bibasar and bibsara. And the extra one is just an addendum that really uses the bibsara in the same way, and therefore you can learn multiple things from bibsara, because it's teaching you that it has to be in the flesh or in the beit arechem in order for it to be tmeya. So now the Gemara says, Tashma, the Gemara is going to bring a number of Mishnayot, brayta that we saw earlier in the Masechta, that seem to indicate otherwise than what Shmuel says, that hargasha is not the determining factor as to whether a woman is a nida or tmeya tumat nida. Those are just notes here that the Gemara is going to bring a number of Mishnayot and brayta, and doesn't bring what are the obvious Mishnayot and Braito that speak about Ketamim explicitly. That is because the Baitos would say that those Mishnayot and Braito that speak about a Ketam specifically also indicate, as we saw in the previous Perek, that there's retroactive Tumah all the way back to the last time she checked the Beged or last time of Kibbutz. And that is an extended period of time. That extended period of time, you could have said that she had a Hargosha B'Laiva Daita, that she had the sensation, but she didn't pay attention to it, she didn't pay heed to it, and that would be an easy answer for those brightot. The brightot and Mishnayot that we're going to bring are focused on stains that are found on her body, or stains on her beget and her body, or instead of her body. In that context, we're talking about a much shorter window of time. In that shorter window of time, you're less likely to say that she had a sensation that she wasn't aware of. Aisha shia oset zracheha, a woman who is urinating, verata dam, and she has a setting of dam while she's urinating. Rabbi Meir Omer, imomedet, tmeya. If she's standing up, then she is tmeya. Vim yoshevet, if she's sitting down, tehora. Hey chidomi. What exactly is the scenario here? Ida argasha, if she had a sensation of the blood being discharged, then yoshevet amai Torah. Then why, when she's sitting down, is it considered to be Torah? Because she had a argasha, and argasha is enough to make her tmeya. Elalav dolo argasha, must be a case where she doesn't have the sensation of the dam leaving. Biktani, and nevertheless it says, omedet tmeya. If she's standing up, she is tmeya. Lola d'argasha. Now it's a case where she had sensation. V'imor hargashat meragayim havai. Problem is, in this instance, there are multiple sensations going on inside of her body. She has a sensation because she's urinating, and she also has a sensation because she had a discharge of dam. So we would say possibly that the urination covered up the possibility of her actually feeling the argosha, and therefore omedet, when she is standing up, hador meraglayim the mikor. In that case, there's pressure in the area of the urinary tract, and because of that pressure in the urinary tract, it causes the urine to backwash up to the area of the mikor, up to the uterus. And then Vayiti Dam. And through that, it washes out Dam from the uterus and brings the Dam of the uterus out. Yoshevet, where she doesn't have that pressure on the urinary tract, then Torah, because the blood that's coming out must be coming from a urinary tract infection or from something in the urinary tract, not from the Mekor. The circumstantial evidence that it's coming out with the urine makes us believe that it's from the area where the urine is emanating and not from the Mekor, not from the uterus. Again, this piece of the Gemara seems to be based on what we saw earlier in the Masechta, that there is some sort of connection between the urinary tract and the vaginal canal, according to Chazal. And therefore, if there was pressure in the urinary tract, it would back up or wash back up the vaginal canal back to the uterus, and therefore it would bring out the Dam HaMekor. That's likely based on that anatomical understanding or belief that they had, and therefore the difference between when she's standing or sitting has to do with that idea of how much pressure there is on the urinary tract to push the urine back up the vaginal canal. It's also premised, as Rashi says over here, that it's not normal for menstrual dam to come out at the same time as urinating. That's an assumption that is not necessarily true, but it's an assumption here. If the urine is discharging blood, in all likelihood it's coming from the urinary tract and not from the menstrual discharge, because of the fact that, as Rashi notes over here, they don't happen simultaneously. And since they don't happen simultaneously, unless there's a reason to believe that there was a pressure or some physiological reason to believe that the menstrual dam was pushed out, then we will not assume that the menstrual dam came out. And that's why only when she's standing and that position makes it that the pressure on the urinary tract causes it to backwash up to clear out the uterus, or bring blood from the uterus. In that instance, we'll be choshesh for it, but otherwise we would not be choshesh for menstrual dam. Tashma, aid. Sheya natun takarakar. She has a cloth that she does a check with that's under her pillow or under her mattress. Nimsa lab dam. And she finds a stain on it. Imagul. If the stain is round, then she is tahor. That's because when she does a check with the aid, she's rubbing it or moving it, and therefore you would get streaking of dam if she found dam with the check. You would not get a nice, round, circular stain of blood. Therefore, that's an indication that it was from something else that put the blood on there. V'mashuch, on the other hand, if it is stained in a way that shows streaking, then she is tameh. Again, echidami. Idar gisha, if she had a sensation of the blood being discharged, agul amai tahor. Then when you have a round stain, why is it tahor? She had a sensation, and now she sees dam, it makes sense that is menstrual dam. Elalav delo argisha. Again, it must be a case where she didn't have the sensation of discharge. Biktani, and nevertheless it says mashuch tameh, that if they're streaking on the cloth, then we assume she is tameh, even though there was no hargasha. Lo, the olam da argisha. It's a case where she had the sensation of the discharge. Veima hargashat aid habai. But over here again, we have suspicion that the sensation he had was the check she was doing with this cloth that caused the sensation, and she thought it was a sensation of discharge, even though the cloth was there. And therefore, we need other evidence or circumstantial evidence that there actually was a discharge rather than simply the fact that she had an argosha over here, because the argosha could have been caused by her checking rather than her really discharging the dam. And therefore, mashuch, if it has streaking on it, the cloth, badai mi gufa ata, then for sure it came from her body. Agul, on the other hand, if it's circular, then there isn't that circumstantial evidence, and in all likelihood it came from an external source. Therefore, she is tahor. Tashma, nimsa al shelo tmeim. If right after they had biyah, they both do a check, which is what the Mishnayot spoke about earlier, the necessity for such a check. So if they checked afterwards and he wiped himself and she wiped herself, if they find dam on his cloth, then they are tmeim and chayevim korban, and they have to bring a korban because for sure, for certain, they were boel nida in this case, because the only reason there could be dam on the member of the man is because she had a menstrual sighting while he was inside of her. And that means they have a problem, a boil nida, and that's why they bring a korban. Nimsa shela, if they find the stain on her cloth, but not his cloth, et yom, as we discussed earlier in Masech, that yom means immediately, and we discuss what is immediately versus the delay. Tmeim, then they're both tmeim, v'chayavim korban, they bring a korban as well, because in all likelihood, this happened during the bi'ah, because she checked immediately afterwards, and there was no time for it to have a discharge after the biyah, that could be the explanation for this dump. Nimsav shalal achar zman, if it's found on her cloth after a delay, after some tarrying, then tzmeim misafek, they are tzmeim misafek, because maybe it happened during the process of biyah, or maybe not. Upturim in a korban, they can't bring a korban because it's a safek. And since it's a safek, can't bring kulin lazara. Hey chidami. Again, what's the scenario here? Ida argisha, if she had a sensation to discharge, lachar zman am I turim in a korban. Then why after time are they turim? If she has a sensation of a discharge, then why when she checks later on and finds the dam, do we say that that wasn't already there from the time of the argosha? Why is she patur min a korban? If we assume that that means that she definitely was in Nida. Elala Abdullah argues, it must be a case where she didn't have the sensation. Victoria, it says, Nimtza al shalayat yom. Nevertheless, it says, if you find it on her immediately afterwards, Tmeim v'chayavim korban. Then they are Tmeim and they are chayav to bring a korban. We assume that he was boel Nida. Even though there was no hargosh over here, he still deem her to be a Nida against Shmuel's position. Where it says, no, the olam dar gisha. It's a case where she did have a sensation. But it was accompanied with a sensation while she was in the process of cohabitating. So she has argosha while she's cohabitating. We're not certain that she can actually be so astute and aware to discern between the sensation of cohabitating and having the shamash inside of her versus the actual argosha of a discharge of dam. Therefore, even though she says she had a discharge of dam, we don't necessarily rely on that because of the fact that there was something else inside of her at the same time that could have caused that sensation. Nimtzata domer, gimel sfeikot ba'isha. There are three different levels of sfeik by a woman. Al bisara, if you find it on her body, sfeik tameh, sfeik tahor. There we don't know if it came from outside or it came from her internally and therefore we have a sfeik. In that case, tameh. We assume that she is tameh. Al chaluka, we find it on her beged, safek tamei, safek tahor. It seems safek. Did it come from her internally? Or did it come from externally? Tahor. In that case, we render the safek tahor. So we'll have to understand why when it's on her body, the safek is tamei. When it's on her clothing, it is a safek tahor. Ube magaot, ube hesetot. When it comes to her touching things, or her moving things, which would convey tumah from her to those items, halei chachara rov. Go after the majority of situations. Where it says, my aleich achar rov. What does that mean? Go after the majority of situations. Lav im rov yameh tmeim tmeah. Bava gabdol argasha. We would explain this to me that if the majority of her life she finds herself being tmeah because of her nida cycles or whatever is happening, she finds herself to be tmeah the majority of her time, we're going to assume that the individuals are tmeim. So Rashi claims over here that a woman is tmeah rov yameh is in an instance where it's a woman who doesn't have a regular cycle, and when she checks, she considers herself tohorah, she can find that she doesn't have dam, but if she doesn't check, she assumes she is tmeah, and therefore she ends up with the case with rov yameh, she is tmeah. The Baalei Tosafot say that's such a far-fetched case, because we know that a woman who has a veset, dayashata. A woman without a veset only has retroactive tumah for 24 hours. Why would you assume that a woman who doesn't have a regular veset is tmeah rov yameha? The Tosfot define rov yameha as a situation in which, when she has a stain on her beged, in the majority of cases, is she tmeah afterwards, or does she have a sighting of nida after she finds a stain on her beged? And that's what the rov is over here. If in rov situations where she finds a stain on her beged, she also ends up being a nida and menstruating, then we will assume here, even though she went through the butcher or shuk and finds a stain, we're going to rely on the robe of circumstances where she finds such a stain that it is the result of or is in anticipation of the fact that she's going to have a menstrual discharge. But the key element which is relevant to our Gemara over here is that Tmeah afagav delo argasha. She's going to be Tmeah even though she didn't have a sensation of a discharge. And despite that, we still think that she is Tmeah. I says, lo. Imrov yameh bargasha chazya. If the majority of her life, when she had menstrual sightings, she senses them with a hargasha, she has a sensation when it happens, tmeah. Then you have a safek. Then in that case, she is tmeah. Di imur argasha v'labadata. Because then we assume that even in these instances where she touched something or moved something, She also had it, and she just wasn't aware of the sensation. The sensation took place, but she didn't focus on it, or she wasn't so attentive to it, and therefore it happened, and we assume she is Tmeya. So now, again, here we're defending this view of Shmuel, that without our Agosha, there is no Tumat Nida. Amar Mar. Now the Gemara goes back to explain this Braita. It has the three Sfeikot in it, which is Al Bsara, Sfeik Tamei, Sfeik Tohor, Tamei. Al Chalukah, Sfeik Tamei, Sfeik Tohor, Tohor. Heichidami. What exactly is the scenario here? Imi Chagur Lamato, if it was below her belt line or waistline, Al Chalukah, my Tohor. Vatznan, and our Mishnah says, Mina Chagur Lamato, Tamei. Imi Chagur Lamala, if it's from her waistline and up, Al Bsara, my Tamei. And when it's on her body, why is she Tamei? Again, for the Chaluk, I understand why she's still around now, because above the belt line, doesn't make sense that it came from that area. But when we find it on her body, we said that it's a fake Tamei, it's a fake Torah, that she is Tamei. So that would mean that if it's above the waistline, that she would be Tamei as well. Why? But it's not. Our mission says, Rata Dama Bsara Shalom Keneged Beit HaTorfah Torah. She sees dam on her body in areas that are not opposite the area where she discharges the dam, then you can't assume that the dam came from there because it doesn't make sense that it came there. So, we have answers in both directions. Some say the explanation is from the waistline and down. Some say the explanation is from the waistline and up. The explanation of it being below the waistline, she had walked through the butcher marketplace. Al Bsara, if she sees it on her flesh, then Migufa Atai, then it definitely came from her. Dima Alma Atai, Al Chalukah Mibayla Ishtukuche. If it came from an external source, it had to go through her Beged to get to her Basar. So she finds it on her body, in all likelihood it came from something internal rather than external, because if it came from an external source, you should have seen a soiling of her tunic, not just the stain of dam on her body. Al chaluka, if we find a stain on her clothing, then me'alma ato, we assume it came from some external source, demi gufa ato, because it had come from her body, al besarami by ledish tukuche, then we should have found a stain or indication of dam on her body. So what we're saying is that when the dam is on the basar, more likely to assign that to her discharge rather than an external source, because by the mere fact that it's on her body and not on her clothing, seems to give evidence of the fact that it emanated or was discharged internally. On the other hand, if you find it on the baguette, then it's just the opposite. In all likelihood, that came from an external source rather than an internal source, because had it come from an internal source, you should have seen dam not only on the baguette, but on the woman herself. She should have had some of the stain on herself. So that's how we explain the different outcomes of the spekot here of the chalukah. And again, it's a chalukah below the belt line. And so therefore, it could have come from her. The question is, which way does the circumstantial evidence lean? If it's on her body, it's more likely it came from her. If it's on her beged, then it's more likely it came from an external source. And Tosfos points out that we only say this when it's bisara and chalukah, when it has to do with her body and the clothing. But if she's wearing multiple layers of clothing, as we're going to see later on in the Gemara, then even if you find it on an inner piece of clothing, and it's not on an external piece of clothing, there we do not invoke the principle that if you find out an internal clothing, it had to have come from through the outer clothing, and why is it not there? Because she might remove or raise her outer clothing because she has a layer of clothing below it. So she might expose it or it can become exposed. What she will not do is raise the clothing that exposes her basar, exposes her body, and therefore in that instance, if you find out her body, it should have or had to have come through the chaluk if it came from the outside. The absence of a stain on the chaluk is evidence that it must have come from internally. The other explanation is that it's from the belt line and up. Kigon is dakra. It's a case where she turned herself upside down. She maneuvered her body in such a way that things that were from below could reach up above, or basically the top of her body now becomes the bottom of her body, because whatever physical position she took, her body now allowed for the dam to flow from down below to the upper part of her body. Albasara, on her body, by daimi gufa atai. It definitely came from her body, dima alma atai, because it came from an external source, alu chalukai by leish tukuche. We should have found it on her beged. And so therefore, even though it's in a place on her body where normally it wouldn't reach, by the fact that she did some physical maneuver that would have allowed dam to flow from down below to up above, we assume that it came from her. Al Khaluka, if it's on her clothing above the belt line, then we assume that it came from an external source, even though she turned upside down, even though she made a movement that could have moved the blood up there. De migufa atai, because had it come from an internal source, al basarai by leish tukuche, should have found it on her body as well. The fact that it's not on her body and only on her clothing seems to indicate it's coming from something external. Tani mihat. Nevertheless, we see from this, al basara, when it's on her body, safek tamei, safek tahor, tamei. If you have a safek, we assume you are tamei. Ve'afa gabdolo hirgisha, even though there was no sensation over here, because if there was a sensation, we would know where it came from. But even without a sensation, we're seeing that she is tamei'ah, when there's a safek tahor, safek tamei, and we determine that it's tamei with the discovery of dam on her body. Votznan, we have another Mishnah that provides additional problems for Shmuel, which is Aroi Ketem al Basara. Someone sees a stain on her body, connected Beit HaTofa, opposite the area where she discharges. Tmeya, she's considered to be Tmeya, but Afal Gav Delo Yagisha, even though she had no sensation. You see here, again, this seems to undermine Shmuel's position, because it doesn't seem to be that sensation is a prerequisite for being Tmei. So I'm Rabbi Yirmiyahu Difti. So here we finally reach a conclusion here where the Amoraim are going to redefine or qualify the statement of Shmuel. So Rabbi Yirmiyahu Difti I Moda Shmuel. Shmuel agrees, Sheit Meya Midrabanan. So here's your answer, that all these tumult that we're speaking about in these Mishnayot, these Tanaic works, were Tuma Midrabanan. And therefore you don't have to give all these different answers we gave. Even absent our Agosha, there is Tuma Midrabanan. Shmuel was speaking at a Do'uraita level. Rashi explains the reason as being the Talina and Dilmar Gasha below Adata, that maybe she had the sensation, but she just didn't notice it. And that's the institution of the Rabbanon here of Tamim, according to Rashi, is the fact that maybe she did have Argosha, but didn't pay attention to it, didn't pay heed to it, wasn't attentive to it, and that's the whole institution of Mid Rabbanon. The Bali Tosafot say that they don't think that's the case, and they believe that even absent Argosha, or where she is certain that she didn't have Argosha, still by Tamim, or by sightings of Dam that we mentioned here, she would be Tmeya Midrabanan, because as the Bali Tosafot say in the end, Rata Dam Nidot, the Dam that is being discharged here is clearly uterine blood, and since it's uterine blood, then it's Dam Nida. And so the Chachamim instituted Tuma then, even though Midoraita, she's not a Nida, but the Dam that's being discharged is Dam Nida. And that would only be furthered by those that believe that the Dam Nida has inherent Tuma to it, even if it doesn't make the woman Tmeya. So then the Dam that she discharges is Tmeya, and the woman remains Tohra. So similar to what we're about to say by Rabbi Nechemia's position, that if the object that is being discharged or used over here is Tmeya, then we will make the woman Tmeya Midrabanan. Vashi Amar Shmuel Ho Damar Ke Rabbi Nechemia. Shmuel holds like Rabbi Nechemia, and that'll solve our problem. It's not. We have a Mishnah further on in the Masechta. Nechemia Omer, Kol Davar Sheinu Mikabel Tuma, Einu Mikabel Kitamim. Anything that is not Mikabel Tuma is not Mikabel Tamim. This is a big kula today, and has major impact with regards to Tamim. That is, that a ketem that is found on synthetic material, a material that is not Mikabel Tuma, then it's not classified as a ketem. The Chachamim only instituted their Gzerah, as Tosafot says over here. Time of the Rebbe Chemia came into Davar, Shea Ketem Bo Tahor, the object on which the Ketem is found is Tahor, Gamal Ishalo Gozru Tuma. Therefore, on the woman, they were also not Gozer Tuma, meaning that if the Ketem is on a Beged and it makes the Beged Tamei, then I'm also going to make the woman Tameah. But if it's on an item or a piece of material that is not Mekabel Tuma, then we're also going to assume that the woman is not Tmeah, because we're not making the cloth Tmeah, even though it has a stain on it. Tosafot adds here that even though Rav Ashi disagrees with the explanation that Rav Yirmiyahu Midifti brings, nevertheless, he does not necessarily disagree with the principle. He agrees, according to the Bali Tosafot, with the position of Yirmiyahu Midifti, that Shmuel believes that your Torah midoraita Tmeah midrabanan. The only thing Rav Ashi is coming to explain is why by Karka are you even Torah midrabanan. That's because it's an item that is not Mikabel Tuma. But that would mean that fundamentally Rav Ashi does not disagree. Although if you look in the Hagot Rauschenberg, he notes that the Tshuvat HaRama seems to indicate otherwise, that they're actually fundamentally arguing. So Bishlam Mother Rav Ashi, according to Rav Ashi's explanation, Hainu Dugamar Karko. That's why Shmuel specifically said his case, in a case where she sat down in a place she checked, and then after she left, there's a stain of blood on the Karko where she sat. Karko in particular, because Karko is not Nekabel Tuma. That's why Shmuel's statement revolved around Karka. Ella the Rabbi Yirmiya, Rabbi Yirmiya Midifti, that says that Shmuel's statement was Doraita, but Mid the Rabbanani agrees that there is Tuma, my area Karka. Why does that have to be Karka? Filu Glima. Nami, even if it's on her cloak. Doesn't matter what you find the stain on. The whole difference between the Shmuel's statement and all these cases we brought is whether it was Doraita or Dorabonon. Where it says, Lo mi boi kamar. It's saying not only this. Lo mi boi glima delo mibdak shapir. Not only in a case where you had a cloak on and it wasn't checked properly, and then afterwards you find the dam, so there might be suspicions that it didn't come from you, it was there beforehand, and therefore you are Torah midoraita and only tmeah midorabonon. Even on ground, the mibdak shapir, you can check it carefully, and it was checked carefully, as we said in the case by Shmuel. Diga the meimar migufatya tahor. Where you could have said, or the more likely outcome over here, is that it came from her body. Despite that, we say she is tahor. That's what it's lo mi bai kamar. In other cases, for sure, she is tahora midoraita. But even in the case of the karka, where, since she checked beforehand, in all likelihood, the dam that's there after she gets up came from her, nevertheless, we're still going to say you are tahora midoraita, because she didn't have a hargosha. And we'll stop here by the two dots on the top of Nunchet Amud Aleph.